explaining to them that
yes,
next
I'll
year, next year when I'm the chair of the transportation committee, that's the point
right.
my staff will be able
you
to
guys
expand.
Better start. You guys better start on. We can't keep it up here. Yeah, but want to share.
The transportation committee will come to order. Let's see. First, we've got a little. Senator Perry is new to the committee, so welcome aboard, Senator Perry. And like we always start off after every election, I always give my little speech about. Try to show up as close to on time as possible. Most of the time, that's not possible. But just come prepared. Everybody sitting around the table comes prepared, and all the folks out there do, and it's always a good thing. So it leads to better discussion. So welcome aboard, and we're happy to have you. With that, we're going to turn it over to MnDOT, and Deputy Commissioner Saheeb Jim is here, as well as several members of the MnDOT staff. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. last week, we had this meeting last week. If you would have had it last week, you would have had the commissioner there. But unfortunately, he had a family commitment, so he could not make it. So you have to, settle for me here. I'll try and do my best here.
Could you just pull the mic up closer?
Okay. You hear me okay? Is it working?
Yeah. Okay. Connie, I tell you what, you just have to speak up. The mics don't amplify much in this room, and kind of sound gets absorbed.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity. I have I'll go through and make it a 15-20 minute presentation at the most and leave some room for questions because you'd like to listen to the Met Council. Also, what I'm here to cover is talk about our vision, direction, our accomplishments over the past year and a half, 2 years, and then some key initiatives that we'd like to share with you. Our vision, our goal, if you look at our little pamphlet, it talks about being a global leader in transportation, being committed and upholding public needs and collaboration with internal and external partners to create safe and efficient, sustainable transportation. And we take this very seriously, members, and we show it by our actions. What we use is the framework that we use to get there is basically our strategic direction in safety, mobility, innovation, leadership, and transparency, and I'll talk about that a little bit. Let me cover a little bit some things that we've accomplished. First of all, the part of the department I'm mostly proud of is the snow and ice, the guys that are out, guys and gals that are out there fighting the weather and the storm, especially during the last holiday storm, Christmas Eve. I had the opportunity. I went to the truck station right by my house down in Eden Prairie, got there at midnight. All I could see was smiles. There was not one person that was complaining about having to work overtime, working late, and being away from their families. And I think that is a fact. And I'm really proud of what they did. Just some numbers as far as how much we've spent so far this year. As of January 20th, $35 million statewide we've spent on snow and ice control. About $24 million is outstate and $11 million in the metro area. And I'm sure it's a lot more than that since we've had some storms since then. The Red River flooding was another piece that I'm proud of. Our folks worked with state-level agencies and other local agencies, and they our own trucks was able to build a dike along Interstate 94 and save and Highway 75 and save those roads and keep them open for the traveling public. Incident management, that's another piece. As you may know, congestion in a metro area is 55% because of recurring congestion, because of bottlenecks and weaving and driving the geometry of the area. And about 45% is non-recurring events, such as weather events or incidents and crashes. Our goal is to to clear the freeway as soon as we can when we have incidents. And our number right now is around 37 minutes to clear a freeway, about an average number. And these are normal crashes that I'm talking about. I'm using a couple of events that we had, a tanker fuel spill on I-94 and a frozen fish that got dumped on the road in Brooklyn Center. Those take about 5 to 8 hours to clear the road. That's not what I'm talking about. So and our first people, our yellow cars that you've seen on the road system is what help us with that. another accomplishment, another bread and butter portion of the department is our construction folks. Chapter 152 bill, we're well into it now. As you know, there's some major construction that will start soon from that legislation. This summer, we're going to start the construction of the Hastings Bridge and the Lafayette Bridge, which is Highway 52 through downtown St. Paul. And those projects, and then we have also coming after that is the St. Croix River crossing, the Dresbach, and the Cayuga projects around the state. and we're looking to try and advance these projects because as best as we can, as we study them more, we get a better understanding of the scope and the engineering, and maybe we can do more sooner. other major projects that we've done and delivered is that one is the UPA in partnership with Met Council and other cities that we opened on 35W. The Crosstown project is under construction. That should be done this year, and that would be the biggest highway project that we've done, $300 million. It will be done expected to be done this summer or fall. And then, and of course, the picture that you see is the 169 project through St. Peter. I believe that was a stimulus project, and that was great accomplishment for a city of St. Peter and our folks down in District 7. kind of in line with this, a legislation that we are looking to, in line with bridges, to hopefully be discussed maybe here, Mr. Chair. I think maybe our bridge engineer, Mr. Dorgan, and his staff, if there's time at some point, can come talk about it a little bit more, is a bridge management legislation where we determine which bridges to start, to which bridges you program based on risk-based analyses. And that's, of course, came after the collapse of the bridge, and we can talk about that in the near future. I always like to show a safety slide. This speaks for itself. Basically, the white portion on the left side is where we had been for many years, and the red line shows where the trend was if we didn't do what we did back in 2003. Basically, we changed our way of doing business, and I'll talk about that a little bit in the next couple slides. But as you can see, when we changed our efforts and how we work with the locals and be more proactive, we were able to reduce our fatalities every year except the year of the bridge collapse, where we had 13 fatalities on the bridge, and unfortunately that counts toward fatalities on our road system. Other accomplishments, we are proud to be advocates of Greater Minnesota Transit. We delivered $45 million in federal and state grants to 64 transit systems statewide. We funded and enabled 33 transit systems to purchase and replacement buses, and three systems advanced bus garage projects. The rail plan, most of you probably heard about that at the joint meeting that we had about the rail plan. That's officially published. And also in the world of aeronautics, more than $65 million in federal funds and $9 million state funds were dedicated to airport work. We've done things like maintenance and new terminal construction, runway resurfacing, and working on fuel systems in 190 airports. Key initiatives, back in 2009, which is last year, we adopted a strategic plan, and with that came a whole bunch of identified a bunch of initiatives. We have lots of initiatives, and here are just a few I'd like to touch on. And if we had time, I'd do more, but that's all the time we have. So I'd like to. Some of these we call our flagship initiatives. These are the initiatives that define our department and who we are and what we want to be. I'll jump into it. The Towards Zero Death Safety Initiative, we will continue on that until we get to zero death. Partnership with all of the four E's, that's basically what we changed back in 2003, education, enforcement, engineering, and emergency medical services. We included all roads, not just heavily trafficked state highway system and the interstate system. We included the rural road systems and worked with the locals. And the other part is being proactive and part of it in our and not be reactive. Wherever there's an accident, we would go do a fix. And you've seen that around the city and around the state with our cable median barriers is one solution. ADA, implementation, American Disability Act. This is one that I'm really proud of. We've always talked about this, and you may have seen in some agencies, they've talked about some states being fined, and they're forced to do these types of projects. And what we're trying to do is change a culture within the department and working in partnership with the public, with citizens with disability, we've been able to turn that around. As a matter of fact, last week we had a mini luncheon celebration with some of the external partners where we've celebrated getting our transition plan done. We adopted a PROWAG, and that stands for Public Right-of-Way Accessibility Guidelines. Basically what this says is that as engineers, you when you design a road, you're not designing it only for the grades and drainage. You're designing it for other things, who uses the road system. And we've done a lot of work to advance that that effort. We're district-wide around the state, we're targeting and trying to identify projects, working closely with cities and counties. This impacts the cities probably more than it impacts us, where they have a lot of streets and curb ramps, roundabouts and things like that to look at and see how it helps the people, disabled folks, to cross our system. We've set aside $2.5 million per year through 2014 will be used for standalone improvements. And, of course, every time we do a project, it will be a part of that. As part of the criteria we're developing for stimulus two, if it happens, we're taking some dollars off the top to set aside for this effort also. And that's if the stimulus two happens. Kind of in line with that discussion, context-sensitive solution. It's an innovation. It's looking at projects differently. It talks about a collaborative interdisciplinary approach that involves all stakeholders in providing transportation facility that fits its setting. Basically, it's not not every project, every design fits every location. So what we want to do is take a step back as we're designing a project, include everybody who the project impacts, both the people who drive through it, people who use it, that live there. And you look at the land use, you look at businesses, homes, and so on, and it's kind of in line with the next bullet, which is a complete streets discussion, which I'm sure you've heard about, and I believe there's legislation proposed for that. There was a nice I thought it was a fair article yesterday in the Star Tribune editorial that discussed this complete streets effort. It is not a way of making projects cost more. We will always try to be efficient and provide the most that we can with the dollars that we have available. It is simply to look at everything that is within that area, the grades, like I said, the geometry, the drainage. Do you need a sidewalk? Do you have a bicycle? Do you have transits? And look at businesses that the highway goes by. Again, this complete streets effort is one that probably impacts the local agencies more than us. We do have trunk highways that drive through cities that have curb and gutter that more looks like a city street. So we will deal with those. But what we want in a department to be able to provide that leadership and maybe help with training with the local agencies in this effort. So this is going to take a lot of effort from the locals. Another quick example I'd like to talk about with regard to context-sensitive solution is designing a solution that's performance-based. There's a lot of discussion nationally about performance-based management. You may have heard about this interchange in the Southwest metro area, and that we were going back and forth with the Federal Highway, and they wanted to build a full interchange, and that's something that we had agreed to in the past. But we knew there was a way to save $30 to $40 million by not building two of the movements, east to north and south to west, because they were basically local movements or people who were lost. The system movements take a different route. And we finally were able to engage the Federal Highway, USDOT, at higher levels. And the problem was that the Federal Highway does not have a policy to do this type of effort. There is no such thing as a performance-based design. You build what you need now, and then you monitor it. If it fails, then you program and build the rest. There is no such thing. So here's an example that we being the state of Minnesota, are in the leading edge nationally, working with the Federal Highway, and we've agreed to some performance criteria on this project that I'd be glad to sometime to talk to you about if you want to, and we're going to build what we need now, and then you monitor certain things, and as needed, we come back and do the fix.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry. Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sahib Jim.
Yes.
So do we now have stimulus dollars to do this project, or are we going forward? This is new news. I hadn't heard that we had come to an agreement with the federal government. So could you talk about where we are in that process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonner, yes, that is one way. We have an agreement to build the project with Federal Highway. Now, the funding will depend on, of course, as you know, there's a Tiger application that's in, and I heard just before this session, this meeting here, that this afternoon, I think the USDOT is going to announce the Tiger applications, which state won what. So if it gets that money, it'll go through. If we receive stimulus dollars, the second round of the jobs bill that's being discussed nationally, part of those dollars, the metro portion, will go to this project. And if none of those things happen, then we're looking internally to look at some looking at, as I mentioned earlier, about the Chapter 152 projects where we have done more discovery and we're able to use some of those bonds to work on to get this project done. So we're hoping that we can do this project possibly hopefully this year, but if stimulus happens, of course, it'll happen much, much faster, and it'll have a 90-day delivery attached to it, so it could go under construction by May if that happens.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Sahibdom, well, thank you very much. You know, that really is big news. I don't know if people understand, but we weren't able to do this intersection, even though it was number one on our priority when we got the first round of stimulus, because of this dispute. So that is a big accomplishment. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just so the committee knows, there were there was a provision that we put in Senator Langseth's bonding bill that captures those last 2 years of the 152 money on the bonding and advances that and lets MnDOT spend it sooner than they would have. So if that goes through, you'll have a little extra. And then we were also going to have some trunk highway bond authorization in our budget bill so that we can put some money in some, you know, the interchange account and things like that. These interchanges mean economic development, and whether it's your district or the one in Senator Dahl's district, you know, they need to get fixed. So, anyway.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, if those dollars get advanced, obviously if there's more dollars to be spent sooner, we'll be able to build projects sooner, and some of those projects I mentioned earlier could be advanced, such as Dresbach or Cayuga project here in town. So we'll be looking at that. If that happens.
Or an intersection over in Senator Dahl's district.
Or an intersection in Senator Dahl's district. Is that,
Mr. Chair, thank you for bringing that up. So you've been out to our district and looked at that 5 and 13 interchange. So that's a good project.
Yes, Mr. Chair. That's another project that's in the Tiger. There's a Tiger application for that. So, okay. Thank you. I'll continue quickly. Innovative financing, obviously, our goal there is to do more with the dollars that we have, and innovative finance strategies can better link the cost of transportation improvement with those who benefit most from that. as you recall, the governor had an announcement with public-private partnerships, and we announced a couple of projects as part of that. One was the Bren Road Interchange, which where United Health wanted to put up some of their own dollars, and that project is going forward. And we had also received some of the interchange funding that the chair is talking about, the trunk highway bonding for the economic development. I'm sure you've heard of the Elk Run Interchange. That's another project that was able to take advantage of that, and we're working on that. I was down in Rochester on Friday and met with a developer and the venture capitalist that's trying to do that work, and they're on track to start their building construction fairly soon. And as we've always said, we would be shoulder to shoulder working with those folks and. To build the interchange, so that could happen this year also. Modal integration. This is basically what we're trying to do. We talk about being a multimodal agency, where you talk about roads, you talk about transit, and other things, and we want to be organized that way too. We've had. Currently, what we have is different offices. Our transit office that deals with buses and bikes, and you have aeronautics and freight office, and now recently a passenger rail office. That, for lack of a better term, maybe in silos to do their own planning and programming. So, what our goal is to have a planning office that you see on our org chart. There's a lot of emphasis on this national levels. And we just want to be positioned to deliver better. This slide, workforce and DVE disadvantaged business collaborative. This is an effort that we are. You probably hear a lot of negatives, a lot of mean things about us, MnDOT. But what I want to say is that we are truly committed. I think over the past 2 years, we have engaged with the contractors and the DVE, and the advocacy groups, more than ever. And we've set up a collaborative effort. We thought this is the best way of doing business. And the collaborative group involves the DBEs, the general contractors, the unions, the training, the schools that do all the training, the advocacy groups, Federal Highway, and us. the department. We had a little setback in back in June, so we were kind of in a hiatus from June to October because things were not going well, to be honest. We had demonstrations in front of our building, and that was no way of doing business. So we hired a third party, a group to come help us facilitate the group, and it's been going really well. The group has been meeting. They met Friday. They met this morning. I won't go into all the details because I don't know all the details that they have agreed to, but they had a productive meeting this morning from what I understand. another side note, if I may go on a little tangent, the state of Illinois asked the U.S. DOT officially the past couple months, they asked the U.S. DOT, can they separate their goals? Right now you have a DBE goal, one goal that the state meets, should meet. They asked, can we separate that out for women and for other minorities? Well, the answer that came back from the U.S. Secretary Ray LaHood was, no, you can't do that for various reasons. But what he said in his letter was what exactly is another example that I'd like to pat ourselves on the back. It says you need to work through these problems through collaborative efforts and involve exactly the people, and literally lists out the group that we have. This is how you become successful in this effort. So I just wanted to mention that.
Senator Watt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, is this an area that is of concern and a priority for the commissioner and for the department?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mao, I think if it wasn't, it wouldn't be in this presentation. It truly is, because I only handpicked a few initiatives, and this one is. It's been taking a lot of our time, which I'm glad we're able to do that and hopefully bring it to a point where maybe we can be a national example. And I know it's not, sometimes it's not going real well, but we're committed to do that. We struggle with sometimes there's federal regulation that has some requirements, and there's contractors that have their thoughts. But it's a very and you have different groups and different opinions. So it is not an easy one, and I'm hoping we get there.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, thank you so much for saying that, because there are a lot of us around this table who care very deeply about this issue. And I know that this is important to the department and to the commissioner and to all of you who work there. But it's good to have that on the record, because there's a misperception out there that somehow this is an irritation that we're being forced to deal with, when in actuality is a principled position, and it is an issue of value to us as a state and as a matter of state public policy. And so I'm grateful for the work that you all have been doing on this, in this area, and for you putting this in your report and for putting that on the record, that it is a matter of priority and it is important to the department and the way we do business in Minnesota.
Thank you. Okay, the very last slide is, I just wanted to touch on a few things. We, if you recall, when the commissioner came on board, one of the goals he had, this is my last slide, by the way, he wanted to re-energize creativity and innovation, and we've been working on that constantly and nonstop, and we're letting our actions speak for itself. What we did was, one of the best places you can get ideas is from your own employees. What we did was an imagination back in September, and many, many ideas came out of that, and here's three of them that I'd like to touch on. One is the workplace of choice. That is basically the health of the department, for us to serve the public best, for us, we need to be healthy. And by healthy, I don't mean we need to have lots of people working for us. We don't need, right now we're about 4,800 people, but that does not mean that. It means that we need to be good managers. We need to understand what externally people need. We need to be engaged in that, and we need to be skilled. We need to have a technical knowledge. So that was one that was really important to our employees. The other one is sustainability. And this, everybody, if I ask everybody in this group to define sustainability in transportation, probably have a different definition. I think basically I can say transportation represents part of the gross domestic product, part of the energy consumption, and part of the pollution that we create. So we are part of the discussion nationally, and we have to be. There's a lot of work going on nationally. The new reauthorization bill will have this in there. AASHTO, the other states, our counterparts are talking about this, trying to define what it is, and we're trying to learn. It basically goes back to livability and how transportation impacts quality of life. And basically it's in three major areas: economics, growth in the economy, environment, and social, which is the quality of life, as I mentioned. with that, and the last piece is tech connections, that our folks thought it was important that we're going to understand the scope of that a little bit more internally. That basically is we'll explore how to expand our use of technology in social media, how we connect and engage with our customers better, because that's an area where we get hit once in a while. So with that, I will take question. I hope I didn't go too long, Mr. Chair.
No, Commissioner Siajem, that was you're right on time. I've got a couple questions, so quickly. One, the governor put some recommendations out, and maybe you can talk about this reduction with the urban partnership agreement.
Sure, Mr. Chair. In the recommendation, there was a $84,000 amount that was identified, a general fund. To answer that, I'd like to first say that reduction will not impact any federal dollars. All the federal dollars that we've spent, it won't impact that. The telecommuting portion of that whole UPA discussion, urban partnership, had to do with for a state to create, I think it was 500 new telecommuters on the 35W corridor. Well, we ended up coming up with 2,400, 2,500 through working with different companies. And so this is basically some general fund dollars that we felt like it was not needed, and that's why it's referenced. And to be frank, if we didn't do that, that would mean $84,000 out of our transit cuts. So we avoided that by doing this. If you recall, last year $300,000 was unallotted, and we also canceled some trunk highway bonds because we did not need that any longer. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Let's go with Senator Ress and Senator Dahl.
You indicate that your first statement was it doesn't have any impact on the federal funds. And explain why it had, and maybe that's what you were doing, but it wasn't clear to me. Who has told you, or what's your authority for saying that it has no impact on the federal funds?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ress, because we have, we've been able to meet our goals for that was set in the criteria for the federal dollars, and we have spent the federal dollars and then the state match that came to that, and we met and exceeded the goals, so of number of telecommuters on the road.
And so, Mr. Chairman, that then frees up those dollars to be spent elsewhere or just cut. Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Aim. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Siajem, on that issue, I know that there's another segment of the 35 that was going to have a northbound additional lane, and I don't know if that's part of this, that these dollars, and I know there was some also going to, that would may trigger some sound mitigation along there, that I think some monies have been set aside for that. Is that affected by this unallotment or this?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, no, it's not impacted.
Okay. Thank you.
Folks, we got started here a little late today. I'm looking at the clock, and I know that the last bill on the agenda, Senate File 2468, is going to take some time. So we're going to postpone that bill to another committee hearing. So watch your list. But if you're here to testify on that bill, you can go because we're not going to hear it. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just mostly want to make a comment. Just want to say thank you. It's clearly been a busy year for MnDOT. This is a great update, and a lot of the initiatives are significant towards zero death and the ADA compliance and the innovative finance, all that. It's the passenger rail plan. It's pretty significant work, so thank you. Thank you for that. I think it's excellent work, too. I did notice I came in just a little bit late, so I missed the rural transit presentation. And thank you, of course, for your work in delivering those federal and state grants. But I did notice that the governor came forward with zero in recommendations for rural transit capital needs, despite, was it 12 or 20, in needs that were identified for rural transit. I know that we're going to have something in the bonding bill for rural transit needs. Don't know how the agency or the governor is going to respond, but I can ask if you'll at least support some modest effort for the capital needs for rural transit.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we that was in our original numbers, as you know, and my response to that is obviously the governor has a bigger picture than us to worry about, so that's where he saw his priorities. So.
Yeah, it was $29 million, and it was second on MnDOT's priority list. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last thing. I wanted to just echo a little bit what Senator Dibble is saying. What I've noticed with the Commissioner Sorrell and yourself, Deputy Commissioner, and others, I mean, the whole department is out into the public. They're at the meetings. They're talking with folks. They're working with us. You're taking on a lot of really advanced initiatives and groundbreaking ideas that I think are critical to where we go forward. I think it has a lot to do with your leadership of the agency and department. And I just wanted to say thank you as well. I think a lot of us would feel the same way. And it's, you know, what's going on in the Department of Transportation, I think, is going to be probably leading the way for how we do a lot of things differently here in our government. You know, that you're going to be, you know, the leader in that, and we'll use it as a model to how we go forward in the next decade. So, again, thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would join my colleagues in my appreciation. I do think that you have set forward an inspiring example of how an agency can and should be run. I've appreciated also the work of the ombudsman, who we've talked about on other occasions but wasn't mentioned in your overall presentation. For any of you members who hasn't had the occasion to ask our ombudsman to go out and meet with angry constituents, she does an awesome job of resolving conflicts, and so I've appreciated that service. And also I've really appreciated, with the innovative financing, your ability to deliver that Bren Road project by working with the business community in the city. So I think that strong appreciation is appropriate. Thank you.
All right. Now for the bad news. No, you're not done yet, Commissioner. No. There's just a couple things that I want to say. You know, over the past 18 years, it has been definitely my pleasure working with a lot of the people inside the organization, and it's been a lot of fun. Sometimes a little stressful, mostly a lot of fun, especially on the days when you get invited over to serve up root beer floats. That's always a good day around Christmas. But we have made a lot of progress, and, you know, the future is looking pretty good for transportation. And I really believe that because of the hard work here, we've set ourselves up not only to use these federal stimulus dollars and get them out there quickly and provide jobs, but we've done it very efficiently and basically with a bare-bones operation. You know, a lot of times the public, they look at MnDOT and they think about three people leaning on a shovel. And, you know, then we get complaints. What they never see is this group of people over here that not only put their 8 hours in every day, but they do more than that.
Yeah.
And it's refreshing to see. I mean, we've got committed public employees in this area, and on behalf of our committee and the Senate, I want to say thank you. You all do good work, and you know, a lot of things were mentioned today about the work that's happened just over this past year. Not, you know, with the rail plan, the DBE, ADA issues. And not once in the past couple years have I not been able to pick up the phone, call somebody, and either get an answer or get the answer to me in a short period of time. And, you know, before this kind of transformation happened, it was a little more difficult to get to that point. So the cooperative spirit has been great, and I, for one, appreciate it. There's a couple things that I want to mention. One's going to seem like a criticism, and it will be just a little, just slight. But, you know, we've been trying to develop our airports in greater Minnesota for a long time. And about every time that we feel that we've pushed the ball forward a little bit, you know, I feel like Charlie Brown, you know, you end up on your backside and you get nothing, and it doesn't feel good. And for those people that do a lot of work around the airports, it means a lot of economic activity in places like Red Wing and Laverne and all these other places. And we need to pay closer attention to that and maybe use some more of our resources to help that, as well with freight rail and our short line railroads. They really help move our economy ahead, and we in the future need to, you know, make some more investment there. But overall, I think that you know, we've done pretty good. We've got a couple of things we have to work on. The last thing that I want to mention is selecting the pavement, the type of pavement for the projects. You know, a couple of years ago, we were in this discussion where we wanted something that was closer to a 50% asphalt, 50% concrete mixture. We all know that concrete's going to last. It's going to last longer, a lot of advantages, cost a little bit more than the traditional asphalt. Now those asphalt costs are up there, and we need to do a better job. I really feel that, you know, looking at this chart from over the past year, because we know that every asphalt or every concrete job has an asphalt component. So there's going to be some asphalt on that job. The inverse is not true. And, you know, I think just for the long-term benefit, that we need to look at how that selection process is done and balance those inputs a little bit better. That federal formula doesn't work anymore. And we need to balance that a little bit better, because those two prices are getting closer and closer to being very cost competitive. So that's about the only criticism I can think of, you know. So if that's the worst of the worst, you all are doing pretty good. So anyway, Commissioner, it's been a real treat. Mr. Arsenault was over to the AFL-CIO building and looked at another new piece of technology that may be coming down the road. I hope that y'all are able to implement that. It's an exciting possibility, and it is the speed of light. We don't have to worry about copper wires anymore, is what I'm saying. So thanks, Connie.
Appreciate it.
Any other comments? Nope. All right. Next up, MnDOT.
Met Council.
Met Council.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Bell.
For the record, my name is Peter Bell, Chair of the Met Council. I appreciate the opportunity to once again come before this committee and update you on some issues that are very important to the Met Council and to transit in this region. There's two major topics, Mr. Chair, I'd like to focus on in the brief period of time we have with you this afternoon. The first is an update really on the Central Corridor light rail line, where we stand with that, and a particular emphasis on a number of issues that have received some press attention lately. Litigation that has been initiated by some community groups along University Avenue with MPR and also with the University of Minnesota. After that, I would appreciate an opportunity to provide an overview of where we stand currently with our transit budget. Before I get into these presentations, though, Mr. Chair, I want to personally thank you for the opportunity to work with you over the past few years. Senator Murphy, you have always treated the Met Council fairly. I think you've treated transit fairly. I appreciate, very much appreciate, the agreement we were able to cobble together in the last legislative session. As you will recall, we spent the better part of a full weekend together hammering out that agreement. Senator Rest was quite instrumental with that. Senator Dibble was very instrumental in that as well. And I think that we serve the citizens of the state and we serve the citizens of the region well with that deal that we cobbled together. There was some creativity that we had to use. We had to prioritize a number of different things. But Senator Murphy, I just wanted to personally thank you for how we have been treated at the council in general, but also how I've been treated as well. I think you've been fair, direct, raised concerns and issues, but have been fair. And I'm just very, very appreciative of that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bell, and thank you very much. And that was an exercise in how to get things done in an environment where, you know, towards the end of session, the water gets polluted. And, you know, we were able to get together and talk about these things, and it is because we've got a pretty good committee here. We had good folks like yourself to work with, and don't ever underestimate when Senator Jungbauer wants to go and talk to the governor's office about getting a little allowance. Let's put it that way. So it all worked out good. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to call it the classic making of sausage.
Yes, it was.
But it was. We were in a problem-solving mode, and we did pretty well. Did some good work last year.
Mr. Chair, it wasn't always pretty, but it was effective. So. Let me move into, I believe all of you have got a handout, and I will briefly go through the portion of the handout to update you, particularly on the Central Corridor. Where we stand now is we are currently in preliminary engineering. As all of you are very aware, there's three phases. There's preliminary engineering is the first, final design is the second phase, a full funding grant agreement is the third phase. We have made our application for a full funding grant agreement last fall. It is currently under consideration by the FTA. We anticipate that they will allow us into final design in the next 2 or 3 months. The period of time, Mr. Chair, that we will be in final design will be comparatively short, from March or so until August or September, when we plan in being receipt of a full funding grant agreement. Another major milestone that the Central Corridor has passed is being included in the President's budget. President Obama has included us in the transportation budget for $45 million. This is the first time that the administration has given their good housekeeping seal of approval to the Central Corridor. Up to this point, federal dollars that we've received have really been earmarked dollars, but not an integral part of the President's budget. They are that part of that now. That is a huge milestone. It's also important to note, Mr. Chair, that of the 35, what's known as New Starts Project and also Small Starts Project, of the 35 projects that are currently being considered across the country, the Central Corridor rates number one. That is a major achievement. Of the 35, I think it bears repeating, of the 35 new starts and small starts projects that the FTA is currently considering across the country, we rank the highest. That is something that I feel very proud about, and I think credit goes to the Central Corridor project staff and all of our partners as well. So we have there's a number of things that are quite positive at this point. There are also, to state the obvious, a number of major hurdles that we have to overcome, and I want to deal with those head on today with you and give you my perspective on them, and then of course entertain any questions you may have. The chief amongst those hurdles that have yet to be overcome are three lawsuits that we currently face. And the first one that I'll address relatively quickly is with Minnesota Public Radio. As all of you will recall, last April we signed a memorandum of understanding, which is really a firm contract on how we would operate or how we would construct the line, if you will, in front of NPR's studios. It says, and we have included this in your packet, Mr. Chair, and I will read an excerpt from this memorandum of understanding because this is really at the heart and center of the litigation. And perhaps before I read it, I'll just frame the question. NPR would like us to put in what's called a GERB slab that rests on steel springs. We are planning on putting in a rubber slab, floating slab, that is very similar, it's identical to the floating slab that we have agreed that with the University of Minnesota that we would put in front of their sensitive research equipment on Washington Avenue. We said to NPR that we will explore a number of different ways to mitigate the vibration. They don't have a concern with EMI, but the vibration in front of their studios. And it is very clear in the MOU, and I'm quoting now, without committing to a specific solution because final engineering is not yet underway, the council will consider as an alternative to low-tune slab that floats on a spring mechanism comparable to the GERB engineering solution that was brought to the attention of CCPO and NPR. Mr. Chair, I think this statement could not be any clearer. We did not make any commitment, firm or otherwise, to a GERB slab. And I think, Mr. Chair, it raises a very important policy question that many people have misquoted me in recent days. So I want to be very clear that I have grave concerns if we allow interested parties along the Central Corridor to, in effect, co-engineer or engineer significant features of any light rail line or any transit system. If we were to allow parties to do that, of course, everyone would want to do that, would be my first concern. But my second concern is if the engineering solution didn't work, then who is going to be responsible for the corrective action? In this case, if we were to agree to the GERB slab, and incidentally, we estimate that's north of $1 million in increased costs, and the GERB slab was not to work, then would NPR be liable for tearing up the street or taking whatever corrective action was necessary? I think MnDOT would not allow. We have to listen to interested parties, and I mean that sincerely. We have to hear what they have to say. We have to listen to their consultants. But at the end of the day, we have to build the line. We are responsible for the line. And it is disturbing to me that I think other parties view that otherwise. We are going to defend this in court vigorously. While it's hard to handicap what the court will do, I feel that our position is strong. I'm sure NPR feels that theirs is strong as well. But I think the language cannot be interpreted any other way than I've presented it to you today. They have initiated litigation, and we are in the process of defending that. The second piece of litigation, Mr. Chair, I'll go into briefly.
Mr. Bills.
Please.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if we could ask our questions now, given that we're on that section. Would that be okay with regard to that matter?
Yeah, if you've got questions about the NPR, go right ahead.
Thank you. So a couple questions. Sure. One is, who will represent the Met Council? Will that be the Attorney General's office? Do you have outside counsel? What is? I have a few, but that's one of them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonnarf, we are not represented by the Attorney General's office like many other state agencies are. We have contracted for outside counsel that will be providing us representation. Charlie Nowen is the attorney's name that will be representing us both here as well as the litigation with the University of Minnesota.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, are we able to fast-track this in the courts enough so that it won't conflict with our ability to get the federal funds? Of course, we're all concerned about how this is going to impact it, you know, because we would hate to lose our competitive advantage in this process.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonner, that's a great question. I neglected to address that. The FTA, you would not be surprised to know that I'm in constant discussions and conversations with them. The FTA has been very clear to me that litigation will not prevent us from entering into final design, which, as I indicated, we will be allowed into in the next month or two. Now, that's separate from them allowing us to get the full funding grant agreement, which we hope to get in August or September. And I have not pressed them on that question. I pressed them on the question of final design. They said that you won't be stopped in getting in final design. And I decided not to push my luck and ask them about a full funding grant agreement. Because, quite frankly, I do anticipate we will be able to resolve the litigation in all three cases by September. But I have said that before, and I have said that we have been on the one-foot line in resolving many of these issues before, and it's evaded us to this point. So final design doesn't appear to be a problem. Full funding grant agreement, I think, would be more of a challenge.
And then finally, Mr. Chair and Chair Bell, why is it that the Attorney General's office doesn't represent you in the way that they represent other agencies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonnarf, I don't know the answer to that question. I know that by law, the Metropolitan Council is viewed as a municipality. You know, we are appointed by the governor, serve at his pleasure. We have to stand for Senate confirmation. But we are really neither fish nor fowl. Technically, we are not a state agency, even though we get much of our dollars from the state. So we're a bit of a hybrid.
Thank you.
But I can get you the more detailed information about that, other than how we're characterized by in law.
Senator Devil.
You raised an interesting point there. That's not what I was going to ask about. But we won't get into regional governance at this point. how do we respond, though, to, and I'm just playing devil's advocate, I don't have an opinion or a position on this with respect to NPR and its claims, but how do we respond to their argument that the rubber slab is just going to be completely unsuitable, it's not going to perform well in cold weather, it's going to set up vibrations that resonate with their building that screw up their recording studio operations, and should it not function well, then there's a whole process of digging it out, and or should it fail over time, whereas their argument is the steel springs will work and last, you know, in perpetuity and avoid their problems as well as future problems that might be presented by having to dig them out and replace them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devil, those are all very fair questions. I need to be clear that our project engineers are very, very clear that they believe that the rubber slab that we are proposing to install, and I have to hasten to add, this is the same one that we're planning on putting in the university, where they're very concerned about some similar, though to be fair, not identical situations. And the proximity is different, and that, to be fair, that needs to be stated as well. Our engineers feel just the opposite. They think that the steel springs are more prone to being corroded by salt and water. The rubber slab is impervious to moisture at all. It's a solid slab, and so moisture can't seep in there. And so our engineers are very, very clear, at least in the conversations I've had with them, that the rubber slab is the preferable mode to go. How this will get decided, I think it will be up to the courts, not being an attorney, but my guess is that the courts will interpret the MOU and not move to the second question of which is the preferable slab. I think the courts, I suspect, will look at the language that I've provided you today in your packet and I've just read, and they will look at that and said, the question really is, has the Met Council given due consideration, you know, to all of the options? And I think it'll be incumbent upon us to demonstrate to the court that we did look at a broad array of options. And then I suspect, but don't know, that the courts will say they have filled their obligation in the memorandum of understanding to look at a number of different options. They're building the line. They have. We've got standards that we have to maintain, and we'll have to perform to that. I think the court would be sensitive to the question I raised, that if they allow... if the court allows MPR to substitute their judgment for our judgment, where would that stop? And I think I suspect and hope the court would be very concerned about that question. And I think I suspect that the legislature and the governor would be very concerned about that question. This would be a very dangerous precedent if people could have their own experts come up and say, well, here's what you should put in at an increased cost, by the way, and then absolve themselves of any responsibility if, in fact, it didn't work.
Well, Mr. Bell, that argument definitely is going to work with NPR because, you know, they're not in the business of transportation. They transport radio waves, which is a lot different than people. And besides, I think that you could probably state with some assurance that NPR's specialty is not transportation. Now, at the other end of this corridor, you can't say that, though, because over there they have the Center of Transportation Studies and they do some of the most innovative transportation and transit work any place in the United States. And actually they've have some world-renowned products that they've put out. So that argument won't work as you go down the line the other way. I really don't understand what NPR's beef is here. They've been given every opportunity to get on board. As a matter of fact, the new studio that they built that is now in jeopardy or whatever they want to call it, wasn't their own designer, didn't their own engineer tell them that maybe since this light rail is going to be running 10 feet from your building that it should be, that you should, when you redesign your building, it should be moved? And they went ahead and built it where they built it anyway. Is that right, Mr. Bell?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding as well, that when they built their building, they were aware of what the alignment was. They did not raise any major issues then. They had the ability to consider that and reconfigure their studio locations by virtue of where the light rail line was going to go and did not avail themselves of that opportunity. Now, I have not, to be fair, have not confirmed that, but I've been told that many times.
All right. Senator Carlson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chairman Bill, I guess what I'm not really understanding here is when you're talking about our engineers versus their engineers, are you working with the consultants in that industry and you're and potentially a contractor should be able to take the risk of this? So there should be a characterization of what vibrations are going to be generated, and there should be a characterization of what MPR can handle as vibrations, and then an engineering solution designed and someone put on the hook to deliver that solution. And I guess that's what I'm not hearing, and we shouldn't have radio people and transportation people arguing about it. It should be the technical people that have done it before.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, you are correct, and perhaps I was not clear. NPR has hired some consultants with expertise, to be fair to NPR, in this area. So it is not NPR's current staff that are, you know, raising issues and concerns. They have technical people that they have hired. We, of course, have engineers at the Central Corridor Project Office, as well as consultants that we have used to determine how to address the legitimate, and I want to stress, the legitimate concerns that NPR has. What you have, Senator Carlson, is essentially an argument amongst the consultants about NPR's consultants versus our consultants and our staff. And my position is that we have to listen to their consultants, which we do. We have to incorporate their thinking, as we are not the repository of all wisdom at the project office. And consultants and engineers of all stripes give us useful suggestions and ideas. But at the end of the day, we are responsible for the line. And we have to make the call. We can't have NPR making the call about what design we're going to use, particularly when in the MOU, which is a legally binding contract, we stated that we are going to consider various methods, but we are not committing to any. And my point is, it's a dangerous precedent to allow NPR to do that, because I would venture strongly that if NPR were wrong in 4 years and the spring mechanism didn't work, that they would be not so open to writing a check to tear up the street and take care of it, which is what we're going to have to do. If we're wrong, we're responsible for that. And I think we have a legal and a moral obligation to make sure that NPR can use their building.
Yeah.
And I don't think NPR has the legal or the moral right to superimpose on us their preferred solution.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Chairman Bell, I guess what I'm wondering is still, this is still a technical issue. And I would compare it to, let's say, the Wakota Bridge, where you hire a design firm to design a solution. And if that solution is somehow either incorrect or is not robust, then that design firm is on the hook for designing the wrong solution.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I would agree with that. We are now just constructing our what's known as our Civil East and our Civil West bid packages. And in the bid packages, you're right, the engineers of the construction firm will, you know, further elevate the design that the project staff has measured. And believe me, if they engineer a solution and that it doesn't work, the Met Council would take action. Of course we would.
All right, we got to move along here a little bit. Let's try and pick up the pace a tad bit. I know that, you know, we're still on the Central Corridor issue. There's a lot of community groups out here that have come and visit me, and there's obviously the issue at the university. So
let me very quickly, Mr. Chair, go through the community groups, and then I'll spend some time on the University of Minnesota. The community groups have raised a number of concerns. You have in your packet a list of demands from the community groups. I think that the sum total of that exceeds $50 million. 2 points I would raise. One is, with a changing of the standards for the CEI, the Cost Effectiveness Index, we were able to, through increased funding from the federal government, funding from the city of St. Paul, and about $500,000 from the philanthropic community, I can go into more depth if you would like, have been able to provide the three so-called infill stations. My frustration, Mr. Chair, is that the community groups and the elected officials all along the line said, far and away, our number one concern is to get the infill stations put in. We've got the infill stations put in, and the litigation came after that. I would be disingenuous if I didn't say I'm very frustrated that we were able to address what everyone said was the number one concern, and we have been able to address that. Second concern I would raise.
Senator Saltzman.
There. You know, on this point, Mr. Chair, I think that we were in the business committee a year ago when we were hearing from a number of neighborhood groups that were talking about all of the concerns they had with the Central Corridor. And I believe, Mr. Chair, that you noted, well, you know, we've been working so hard to get the Central Corridor bonding passed, and now we hear all these issues. So I am very disappointed that the neighborhood is not focusing on the economic development and jobs that the corridor will bring to this area. And seeing this list, it really is disappointing to those of us who have worked so hard, who will not directly impact from this corridor, but see that it's an important corridor reaching out to the East Metro area. And these just seems like roadblocks, and I think that they are really missing the point of what a wonderful opportunity this is. So I just want to make that note that, yeah, I think that you've been very responsive again, but I'm sure that if you dealt with this list, there would be another one. So those are my comments.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman. You know, in regards to the community groups, you know, change is really difficult. And, you know, this community underwent some change, some 30-plus years ago when, you know, I-94 was redone. You know, so there's some historical perspective there, and they have some deep-seated mistrust. And I'm not going to say that it's all that misplaced. I mean, you know, that was a different day in those years. And you know, we bulldozed through neighborhoods, and it split a community in half. And a lot of the people, and I know some folks that live down there, some business owners are going eat at the best little steakhouse on the planet for $12, great food. You know, they've seen things happen in the past, and they feel that they weren't dealt with in a very fair manner. I think the Met Council is trying to do everything that they can, you know, to bring some of those folks along and realize the economic powder keg that they may be setting on. But that still doesn't, you know, assuage those concerns about where are my customers going to park, who's going to plow the new alley that you're going to bore through the back of my property for access. You know, there's still a lot of these questions that are unresolved, and I can understand why they're nervous. I just think with a lot of discussion and more cooperation that, you know, hopefully we'll get past some of these. But Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have to say that I think that both the business community and the residents who live in the area have a legitimate concern about this project moving forward. When this city and all of us had given up on University Avenue, those businesses and homeowners came in and bought homes and invested in those businesses. Before Sexy Central Corridor came through, people used the little resources that they had on them because it was affordable. And they brought their businesses and their families to University Avenue. I don't think that those people were in front of this committee begging for Central Corridor to go through because somehow they were going to benefit by it. So as policymakers, we may think that at the bigger 30,000 feet level that it is good for them and they should be grateful that we've done this to them. Maybe we should take a walk and go ask some of those businesses on what the real impact is going to be for them and their families. I have relatives who live in Frogtown, and they very well will lose their homes or their businesses when this great idea goes through. And I'm a big supporter of Central Corridor. But the property taxes and the costs associated with this great project is going to price some of those people out of living in that neighborhood or operating their businesses in that neighborhood. And in all the conversations we've had on this project, we don't often think about who the owners of those properties are and who the renters sometimes of those properties are. And maybe the great economic boom that's coming to that area may benefit the property owners because of the increased value in their properties. But the small businesses who rent those businesses who may not be able to afford to continue to operate in those areas will lose out. The Asian American community came to St. Paul and invested on University Avenue when it was the pits because I-94 drove out the community that was there. And today, maybe 10 years from now, that corridor may no longer look like it is today. So I don't know if it's a job of the Met Council. I don't know if it's a job of this committee. I don't know if it's a job of Ramsey County or the city of St. Paul to respond to these issues. They are real, and these people are not bellyaching about something that they ought to be grateful for. Sometimes for some of these families, that little small business or that little small restaurant is all that they have, and they've poured their whole heart into it for all of us. And so I just want to put it on the record that as we move this forward, and I carry the Central Corridor bill, that we are not dismissive of the real impact that Central Corridor is going to do to these businesses and the people who live in that neighborhood. And yes, the stops will help, but again, Chairman Bell, I'm not saying this is solely your responsibility, but I think there's got to be a conversation about who's going to have a conversation about how this is going to impact those businesses. And I hope that among those of us around this table that we're not dismissive, because, Senator Saltzman, if another list comes, this committee should look at that list, because people may be losing their homes and their businesses that they've poured their hearts into for the last 30 years when that avenue was the pits, and they came and they rescued it.
Senator.
Senator Dibble and Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I thank Chairman Bell for bringing this list forward because, you know, it's I read it, and, you know, these are real legitimate issues and legitimate concerns. I agree that LRT and the potential for revitalization and development and redevelopment is tremendous, and the benefit to University Avenue might be tremendous. But it doesn't happen by magic, and it doesn't happen by itself, and the consequences to people already in place can be very serious and very dire. So your points, Mr. Chair, about, you know, the history of what's happened in the Rondo neighborhood, especially when 94 came through, were right on point. And so it's good. You know, I don't know that the subject of a lawsuit that includes all of these demands focused on the project and focused on the Met Council, to Senator Moore's point, you know, is right on target. But these are issues that I'm happy are being brought forward because they are real. And it is going to take an absolutely essential partnership, which I think is largely in place, but it takes a lot of work and a lot of care between the philanthropic community, the business community, the neighborhood organizations, the activists, the neighbors themselves, and all the public agencies, the legislature, the city, the county, et cetera. We talk a lot about transit, the benefits of transit, and what's going to happen to our communities in a very, very positive way. But we have to be mindful. And this is a great way of really understanding transportation in the larger context, mm-hmm. Something that I talk about all the time. Transportation is not merely just moving ahead from, you know, downtown Minneapolis to downtown St. Paul. It's about everything that happens in between and all of the associated policies that we're trying to fulfill and aspire to all along the way. Development, redevelopment, economics, jobs, quality of life, our environment, et cetera. So, you know, I'm glad this is raised in this committee. I think, you know,
for the first time in this level of detail. So it's an important conversation to have. I hope we can get through this lawsuit, address the issues that can be addressed with respect to the project, project resources, the Met Council itself. But somehow we can address some of these larger issues. Some we're going to have to address in the Tax Committee, the Economic Development Finance Committee, and other places as well, as well as City of St. Paul, Minneapolis, and the counties.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Ma. You've expressed it very well, and I don't live in the area, but I have been hearing the concerns from people who have had, by one way or another, had connections. From people and business people who don't know how they're going to survive construction. Never mind what benefit or loss of benefit they get after the line is there. To ones who are trying to just even address parking for their businesses and approach the city and say, we would acquire some land for parking in another area, but the city is not interested in rezoning to allow it to happen. There's a lot of concerns raised, and I think they're getting the feeling, without it being said, that we've got other plans and we don't want you here. And I think maybe it's about time that there's a little honesty there. If that's the case, then for heaven's sakes, level with these people instead of them hanging on and struggling and losing all that they have given to that area. So I'm with you 100%.
Yeah. Mr. Bell, we're going to finish up with the discussion here on Central Corridor, if we could do it in the next 7 or 8 minutes. And then, you know, the rest of your presentation on the update and the budget and everything, we'll kind of get through that as we, because we have to do our budget committee next week. And so we're not going to hear bills probably next week. We're going to do our budget, all right? And we'll be hearing from you at that time. If you want to finish up on the Central Corridor.
I will. Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to respond very briefly to some of the comments that have been made and move on to the University of Minnesota. It has been mentioned that the activity that took dividing the community 35 or 40 years ago, I'm not sure the community, all the members of the community are aware of this, that I grew up in that neighborhood. My house was taken in that neighborhood, 912 St. Anthony. So I don't think anybody that comes before you can speak with more authority than myself personally, not as chair of the Met Council, but someone whose house was taken. 912 St. Anthony, 94 took my house out. And so I know, I understand what many of the issues are. 2 points I would make. I've just passed out a 5-page document of all of the activities that are currently underway to address many of the issues. I don't want this committee to think that nothing has been done to address many of the, as Senator Dibble had mentioned, many of the legitimate concerns. This is a 5-page document of work that has been done to date. In addition to this, the Met Council is contributing $1 million to a business mitigation loan fund that we're going to be doing, that's just our contribution to it, that we're going to be doing in conjunction with the City of St. Paul and the philanthropic community. And I am not prepared to announce today, but we are looking at some additional efforts that the Met Council is going to be undertaking for some of the very real issues, particularly around issues of business mitigation. I think those are real issues. Parking during construction are real issues. Making sure that the businesses can survive so that they then have the ability to thrive after. These are not insignificant concerns or issues, and we take them very seriously. This 5-page document is an illustration of that. The $1 million we're committing to the revolving loan fund, a low to no interest revolving loan fund that will even consider some loan forgiveness, as well as another major initiative that we're just working on the details to be announced in short order. So while I believe we cannot address all of the issues on that list, I think, quite frankly, another list would come after that. We still have a responsibility to address the very real concerns that have been put forward. And I take that very, very seriously. I've met with the community groups numerous times, the businesses along the corridor. There are some very real issues. Final point with that, and I'll move to the U very quickly. The city of most of the issues that have been raised are not under the purview of the Met Council. They're city or county issues. And I think there's an increasing realization. Given the shortness of time, Mr. Chair, let me move to the university very quickly. University is has initiated litigation because they claim we did not follow what's known as the NEPA process. And there's a state version of the NEPA process and a federal version of the NEPA process. They are suing us for lack of compliance with the state version. They have, around March 1st, the right to sue under the federal version of the NEPA process, and we are unclear whether they will take that course of action. It's important to understand that the FTA disagrees with the University of Minnesota that we did not comply with the NEPA process by giving us the record of decision. They would not have given us the record of decision, nor would they say they're going to allow us into final design if they agreed with the university's position that we have not done that. The university has set up a system, a process, that we have reluctantly agreed to. But what it is that we would set standards for both vibration and EMI is the first box. The second box is that we would set up a mechanism to monitor the standards for vibration and EMI. And the third box is that we would have a process for remedies. We have made progress. We have the standards established. That is a done deal for vibration and EMI. We also have the process for monitoring the standards. The university wanted contiguous, ongoing monitoring. We wanted periodic testing. We were able to come to a common sense middle ground solution. Where the hang up is in the third box. It's in the remedy section. The university's position essentially is this. If we violate the standards, if you say the standard is here, and we violate the standards, they want us to take corrective action to be above the standards. They also want, if we don't do that, they want liquidated damages of $25,000 a day and injunctive relief, which means they can stop the train. And this is with no harm. Now, I want to be clear, to university research or equipment, they want the right to do that. Our position is that remedies should only kick in when there is harm to university research or university equipment. The university made a very valid point to me. They said, Peter, if we wait till there's harm, that could be millions of dollars worth of damage that is done. I said, fair point. I have offered them two compromise solutions. One is if we are operating just a technical violation below the standard, but, and this cannot be overstated, no harm to research, no harm to equipment. We would take corrective action if there is the threat of imminent harm. That's the first compromise. They rejected that. Second compromise offer, I said, is that after a period of extensive, informal dispute resolution, if we are below the standard and there's no harm to university equipment or research, we would send that to binding arbitration. That seems like a fair, common sense way. We would allow an arbitrator to say to the U, well, look it, they're just slightly below the standard. You can do all your research. Why should they slow up this train or not have a three-car train, just have a two-car train? Why should they do this? No harm. Or the arbitrator could say to us, we don't care, Met Council. You're below the standard. The trend line doesn't look good. You have to spend $2 million or $3 million fixing that. I think that that is a common-sense, workable solution. The university apparently has rejected that idea as well. I think it is not in the public's interest to do corrective action absent a problem, or at least the potential of a problem. The university feels that if they can't have liquidated damages or injunctive relief below a standard when there is no harm, even when there's no harm, that they should be allowed to really compel us to take that corrective action. We are stuck, Mr. Chair, on this point. Even though both sides admit that the probability of that is relatively low, I have severe concerns about the precedent-setting aspect of this. If we were to acquiesce to this, what I have found out is that my friends in Eden Prairie and Hopkins and St. Louis Park, where we're going to do the Southwest Corridor, would ask the same things. Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center for the Botno Boulevard would ask for the same things. I have learned that everyone reads these documents and fly specs them and often asks for the same treatment. Final point, the U says that if we are allowed to operate below the standards, they cannot guarantee prospective researchers a stable research environment. This is a very important point. What guarantees do they currently give on Washington Avenue for a stable research environment? There are 20,000 cars, buses, and trucks every day on Washington Avenue. I have asked the U to tell me, we could run 10 semis down Washington Avenue. We could run semis down Washington Avenue for an hour, and the U could not take any action. They cannot guarantee a stable research environment today. They are asking us to adhere to a standard of a stable research environment that they currently are not providing researchers at the University of Minnesota. I think that's an unrealistic and an unfair expectation. I believe we have offered good faith, common sense solutions. We are going to continue to work with the U in hopes of getting resolution to this very important question.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bell, what is there a correlation between the illustration you just used with the semi-trucks and the light rail in terms of some of these the impacts that the university is concerned about?
Mr.
I mean, are they breaking standards in your view, or do you have any evidence of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, there are no standards now on Washington Avenue. Zero. Mm-hmm. And to your first question of do they create the same problem, absolutely. There are two issues. Vibration, which comes from heavy bodies, buses, trucks, and light rail vehicles, all create very, very small amounts of vibration, but it can affect equipment. I want to underscore, the U's got legitimate concerns. I have toured the labs. This is a multi-million-dollar operation that's doing cutting-edge research. And huge bodies of metal create EMI, electromagnetic interference. So if you've got a huge semi going in front of a lab on Washington Avenue and another huge semi coming the other way, this would cause a huge amount of EMI now. They are not, I have asked the U to present me documentation of the guarantees they have given to prospective professors today. They have given me none. I said, you can't guarantee a research environment. Why are you holding us to a higher standard than you're holding yourself? Further, all of the mitigation that the university currently does is at site, on the labs, at the labs. So they will buy a table to absorb the vibration. They have demanded that we do all of the mitigation on the corridor itself. It's much more expensive. The first position we should have taken, quite frankly, is we'll do all of the mitigation at the labs. The university is not digging up Washington Avenue, creating, putting a slab down for the trucks and semis that currently go by. They are asking, in my judgment, to adhere to a double standard, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair, we just one thought. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Mr. Bell, the trucks are running on rubber. But the trains wouldn't be. Does that make a difference?
No.
It doesn't?
Well,
in terms of the metal, the EMI that you're talking about?
No. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, in fairness, the train, given the weight of the train and the like, does create more EMI than the trucks would. But it's not based on rubber tires. My real point is they can't guarantee an environment currently on Washington Avenue, and they're asking us to guarantee an environment. We have agreed to design, engineer, and construct to the standard. We think remedial action should be based on actual harm. I would hate to have my predecessor come to this body and say they need $2 million or $3 million in a bonding bill to correct a problem at the university. And when queried about what's the problem, they said, well, we didn't meet the standard. And they would say, well, is there any problem with research? No. They can still do the research. I don't think that's a good use of public dollars, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, Mr. Bell, I appreciate you coming. We're going to take Senator Metzen's bill and a couple other things, but I'm going to have the last word here. All right. I'll tell you what. If this rolls around sometime after Easter and we're not all wrapped up, I'm going to put Senator Moi, Senator Bonhoff, Senator Carlson, Olson, Dibble, and Fishbach in a room, and they're going to write the standards for you and the university, and it's going to be a done deal, okay? And now, most of the time, I don't make veiled threats, so don't take that as a veiled threat. I will do that. So, you know, Mr. Bell, we've got a huge investment over there that is that's a state and privately run institution. It is one of the landmark institutions in Minnesota. I think we can all agree to that. And the university does wear big pants as well, and we should appreciate that because they are an economic engine too. We don't want to do anything to disrupt their services. Now, to the university, I'll also say that the train's coming through. I think you all realize that. I think the university wants it there. They've got a lot of transportation concerns with their student body. And we need to tie this up, okay? So you all get back in a room, let the professionals take care of it. Otherwise, we will. And everybody's going to be unhappy with that, okay? So
I hear you loud and clear, Mr. Chair. I hear you loud and clear.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bell. Senator Metzen.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fishbach, I'm sorry.
12 minutes ago. Mr. Chair, do you know when the Senate is going back into session? Because a committee is not supposed to meet during while we are in session without permission of the
when
Senate.
When are we going back
into
session? What time?
2:30.
So it's just a skeleton crew, right?
2:30.
Is the Senate under call?
Well, skeleton crew or not, Mr. Chair, we are not supposed to meet while the Senate's in session.
Senator Fishbach, I'm very well aware of the rules. I was around here when they wrote them.
Mr. Chair, then we need to make sure that...
But we don't even know if we're in session. Senator Metzen.
And, Mr. Chair, that's why I was asking.
We're going to find out. Senator Metzen, do you want your bill heard?
Yes.
All right.
He hasn't put us on the call then.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And Senator Fishbach, I don't mean to be short, but, you know, I don't agree with going in recess to the call of the chair.
We'll be
back whenever I want. I don't agree with that.
Mr. Chair,
so
I agree with you, and that's why.
We need to conduct business.
That's why I want to make sure that we understand that this is a problem. And
Mr. President, now you've heard this discussion. Now, when you have your discussions with the majority leader, please tell him set a time specific, sometime other than when we're trying to conduct business. Senator Metzen, on your bill.
Yeah, this, Mr. Chairman, members, is a repealer. What happened, there's a swing bridge, Rock Island Bridge, between Invergrove Heights in Dakota County and Newport in Washington County. What happened is that the city, the mayor, and the council, and the Parks Commission in Invergrove Heights wanted to save a portion of the bridge on the Dakota County side so they could use it. It would be an extension of the parkway or the walkway from Hastings, Minnesota to Minneapolis. And there's a city park down there. So they thought it'd be a great idea to have the children and, well, everybody, by matter of fact, to be able to walk out on the pier, view the river from on top of the pier. And so they were knocking this thing down, and then the council and the mayor and those folks were a little late in getting to me. So I had to put a quick moratorium so they couldn't knock down the Dakota County side of the bridge because it was built in 1890.
Senator Metzen, is there anybody here to opposition of the bill?
No.
Seeing none, Senator Seidman moves that Senate File 2239 be recommended to pass.
I think it switched to 2253.
I'm sorry, Senate File 2253.
Could I?
Does he want to amend it?
Effective immediately.
Senator Seidman moves. Is that okay, Senator Metzen?
Well, I was just thinking.
We got your effective date now.
The effective date, I was thinking of consent. There should be no, just a local.
Senator Seidman,
unless somebody.
You'll amend or motion to put it on the consent calendar.
Yes, Mr.
This
Chair.
Is not a big deal, members, just so.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's really not.
This is really not a big deal. All in favor of that disjointed motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Now we're cooking, all right.
Hey, now you're moving. Thank you.
Let's get on here to the next one. We have Senator Seidman. You have Senate File 2314.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate File 2313 simply clarifies language that's currently in state statute regarding when a car makes a left turn. It helps to clarify that the vehicle should turn into the lane that is nearest to the center line. And this issue came to my attention because Officer Felix from the City of St. Paul Park Police Department made a traffic stop, and then there was a subsequent order by a judge to dismiss the case because the statute was unclear. So if we could hear from Officer Felix, he can better explain the situation.
Officer Felix, can you give us your name for the record and your best 45 seconds? No, I'm your full testimony, please.
My name is Robert Brian Felix. Mr. Chair, if I could continue. Mr. Chair, members, I'm police officer of the City of St. Paul Park. I've been a police officer approximately 3 years. The incident Senator Seidman is speaking of, back in October 2008, I initiated a traffic stop on a vehicle for what I felt was a left turn violation. The vehicle turned into the farthest traffic lane instead of turning to the closest lane immediately to the right of the center line. Upon stopping the vehicle, investigation, I determined the driver was extremely intoxicated and he was arrested for DWI.
Good for you.
Subsequent testing showed the driver, his alcohol concentration was 0.22, which is almost three times the legal limit. In reviewing the driver's driving history, I noted he had the DWI I arrested him for was his fifth DWI in 9 years. And four of his five DWIs were minimal alcohol concentration of 0.22. So this is a habitual DWI offender who is obviously not learning from his mistakes. Upon going to trial on this, the defense argued that, according to the statute's language, the individual he felt did not violate the law because he did turn to the right of the center line, as the statute states,
right.
Just not the immediate right of the center line because that was not in the statute. The judge agreed with him. The charges were dismissed, and if I can quote what the judge said, the detail of the statute's wording leaves, as he quotes, the reader confused at best as to the conduct that the statute seeks to regulate. Just kind of in conclusion, I feel that an habitual DWI offender, a felon, was let off due to the vague wording of the statute, and I feel that this is a tragedy. I feel he is not learning from his mistakes, and he's, in my opinion, going to keep doing what he does, and he might end up killing somebody, and I think that'd be a very tragic offense. So I am not asking for a new law. All I'm requesting is the current law be corrected so this doesn't happen again.
Senator Jungbauer.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, Senator Seidman, I guess I'm in opposition to this bill, and I'll explain why. Under this scenario that we've got here, if it's a four-way stop, I would have no problem with it. Where I'm at on Highway 65 in East Bethel, we have turn signal lights with nice arrows where we finally get to go when we should and don't have to worry about hitting other people. However, when you have a single lane going into two lanes on the highway, a lot of times the dump trucks hauling big excavators and things will pull into the closest lane, and when you get behind them, you can't accelerate, and people are coming from the other side turning into that lane. And I have a problem with that because you can't clear traffic. The way the timing is, and I've talked to MnDOT about this many times, that the way the timing is, and with vehicles like that, at this particular intersection especially, we can only get four vehicles through at a time before that light changes if you do this. And so people are ending up going to the other lane, which causes another problem because the people that are supposed to stop never stop, and we do get accidents there where even though you have the green arrow, you can't get into either lane, which you should be able to when you have these bigger vehicles. So I'd be in favor of this if we can clarify some things turning from a single lane onto two lane like this with a green arrow, then I think you should be able to go into either lane so that you're not hindering other traffic.
Mr. Chair, I guess I just turned to council to see that, to ask council if subdivision F, where local authorities would have local authorities in their jurisdiction would have the authority to construct signs or ways that could account for situations like the one Senator Youngbauer described. In this case, could his municipality clarify that with a sign if they wanted to?
Senator Sieben, Ms. Berzosky says that that is probably an unintended consequence of F, is that those communities would have the ability under F to do what Senator Jungbauer is talking about, disperse the traffic as it goes around the corner. But. So, Senator Jungbauer, Section F covers your concern. The local municipal can do that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, I don't think they can, because in this case you're going from a county road onto a state highway, and you would think that you're covered anyway because only one side of the traffic has a green arrow. We'd have to clarify that, but again, if I don't know who I can't remember who I've been talking to at MnDOT, but you can call MnDOT because they've had many complaints from me over the way that this particular type of intersection works. Frustrates the heck out of you when there's 20 or 30 cars piled up and you can only get four out of the intersection because we assume that that's probably what you're supposed to do already is pull in the nearest lane. But because we have a lot of construction equipment traffic out there, it just doesn't clear much traffic through.
Well, it's already the law. You're supposed to turn into that direct lane. I mean, that's already law. This is just cleaning it up. So, Senator Jungbauer, I suppose that I don't know how you'd write that there, because if there was two different jurisdictions, who knows what's going to happen. But time's short here. Senator Sieben, you want to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd move that Senate file 2314 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
That is the appropriate motion. In between there, here and there, talk with Senator Jungbauer and see if MnDOT might not have a
Mr. Chair, solution. It's my fault for not checking with MnDOT, but the Department of Public Safety was neutral on the bill, too.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you guys talk a little bit between here and the floor, all right? Thank you. And thank you, officer, for coming today. And, next time you pull over a guy that's got five priors, give me a call, will you?
Thanks.
On the Sieben motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Next up, we have Senator Carlson. And like I said earlier, the Murphy bill has been held over. Senator Carlson, 2453.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We're going to go a little faster than planned, I think, right now, because we're already late, I see. What this is a very simple bill that adds a bicycle to the language that allows a person to stop at a light and then proceed if the light won't turn green for them. And what this if we want to go into, I'm going to go into the technology just a little bit. What you have in the street is a metal detector. If you look at these controlled intersections for a left turn lane or for a computer-controlled light, you'll see a little saw cut on the road, and there's a loop in there, a metal loop. And as you drive over it, it detects metal. It detects steel the best, and it detects other metal. If your bicycle, if your motorcycle is not large enough to give you the kind of mass that it that changes the frequency of the sensor, then it doesn't sense it, and the light will never turn. So what we did in years ago is we changed the law so that a motorcycle that doesn't change that light can proceed through the intersection after a reasonable stop and after looking for oncoming traffic. So what we're doing with this bill is adding the ability for a bicycle to also not break the law when they proceed through a red light. And I have with me three testifiers, but what we're going to do is I'll indulge just a bit. I'll have Dorian Grilly from the Bicycle Alliance to give you his very brief comments. And then what we have is a handout of One Minnesota Bicycle Commuter's Daily Ride, and he might give you just a couple of seconds of testimony. So, Mr. Grilly.
My name's Dorian Grilly. I'm the Executive Director of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. And we obviously support this bill. Unchanging red lights are an issue for bicyclists because it leaves them in a vulnerable position on the roadway. It has the potential to create safety hazards, clog intersections, and inconvenience other vehicle drivers that are stuck behind that bicycle. We think making this simple change would improve conditions for all vehicle drivers. And we at the Bicycle Alliance are a big promoter of are a big believer in the fact that bicyclists fare best when they act and are treated like the drivers of vehicles. And it's our goal to teach more bicyclists to obey the rules of the road and act like vehicles. And that includes stopping at stop signs.
Thank you. Your next testifier?
And Mr. Chair, on we have Mr. David Henry, who is a citizen bicyclist and who also rides a bicycle to work every day.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I think you all have a packet that I prepared.
Mr. Henry, you have to state your name for the record.
Oh, sorry.
Please.
My name is David Henry. I'm a resident of the city of Edina, Senate District 41.
Thank you.
I do ride every day to work between Edina and downtown Minneapolis. I follow a route that's 5 miles on streets, 5 miles on trails. There are about 12 signals on my route. I've identified four here, depending on which way I go. There's usually three. That I cannot trigger with my bicycle, and I face a predicament of not being able to travel through that intersection legally. Here's one of them in Edina at Vernon Avenue and Interlochen Boulevard. When I come down in the morning hours, there's usually not a car in this left lane to trigger that left arrow to allow me to go left, which actually on Interlochen there's marked bike lane. Another one is up when I go to cross Excelsior Boulevard. In the morning, again, this is much later in the morning than when I go through. But when I get here, the traffic's going back and forth east and west on Excelsior Boulevard, and it won't the light won't trigger unless a car comes from either direction. And, of course, my bike is not a car, and therefore I sit and wait and wait.
And for then, a car to show up.
Yeah, for a car.
Yeah. No, I understand.
And then finally, 36th and Wooddale up in St. Louis Park. This is actually about 75 yards from the Cedar Lake bike trail that is called by its Three Rivers Park District the superhighway for bicycles. And then the final one, there's one on Excelsior in France that I can't trigger. This is sort of my snow emergency route that I take when the trail's not plowed. And that one won't trigger either. I've got to just find my way through this intersection on my own. And there are a number of people. This is just a group of folks that work with me that commute on bicycle throughout the winter. The number swells to over 100 in the summer. So more and more folks are running into this problem as the technology of the signals changes. When I was a kid, signals just cycled automatically regardless of traffic levels. And now with these sensors in the ground, we're stuck on this one. So certainly recommend approval and passage of the change.
Mr. Chairman?
whole group of polar bears there. Senator Olson.
Well, I think, I don't know, MnDOT, well, yeah, there's somebody from MnDOT here. I wonder if there's any innovative technologies that could ever solve this. I mean, without, I understand doing just a plain solution of being able to ignore a red light, even though you're talking about trying to teach them to honor and respect that, we're going to make it legal not to. But is there a potential at all out there?
Yes, there is, Senator.
For technology?
Yes, there is, Senator Olson.
But is it expensive? What's the deterrent to
it? It's probably going to be a little spendy on the rollout, but as more and more of this technology becomes available, the price will be drastically reduced. There's a company in Minnesota that's what I was talking earlier with Mr. Arsenault about. Bernie Arsenault at MnDOT, some creative technology that uses photons and computers, and they would definitely be able to change the light for you. It's amazing technology, and the complete development might be, or the development is done. All they need to do is get it on the street now, basically. So.
Mr. Chairman, is it something that's in the street, or is it something that the side that you pass by?
This would be overhead in the lighting. It deals with LED lighting, which is kind of photon. This is the part of electricity that is way over my head, too. So. I'm going to leave it at that. But there is technology out there that's going to make a lot of this stuff that we're doing today obsolete. So, Senator Carlson, do you have any other final words before we pass your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have Mr. Steve Clark from the League of American Bicyclists.
Oh, Mr. Clark, please.
Mr. Chair, Senate committee members. Yes, I'm Steve Clark. I live in St. Paul. I also work as a contractor with the League of American Bicyclists, certifying new instructors throughout the country. And we take great pride in teaching safe traffic principles, which includes, of course, stopping at all red lights and stop signs. We want cyclists to be law-abiding. Unfortunately, what we have right now is a situation where cyclists cannot be law-abiding and also actually get from point A to point B. So this is a very important law to the national organization. We support strong enforcement programs throughout the country, and we would like to support enforcement here. But again, we can't support enforcement if we're going to be penalizing cyclists for doing something that would just get them unstuck from an intersection. And I'm like David, I've had those experiences where I'm stuck at an intersection, and I'm trying to communicate with the motorists behind me. You have to move up, and they're looking at me like I'm crazy, like, what's he doing? What's he doing this for? And finally, maybe they'll get the idea that I need them to trip the light for me, but they're frustrated, I'm frustrated. We need this as an intermediate solution before the technology comes in place. Thank you. Right.
Mr. Chairman? Right.
Thank you. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I've wondered about... Some of us are less patient than others when you talk about how if it's been on for an unreasonable time in that determination even under the current law. But should we put a sunset on here for after a period of 3 to 5 years or something and to relook at it and see whether the technology has, in fact, come or not?
That's a good idea.
It's actually Senator Scoy's idea, but he's letting me do it.
I like the idea.
I mean, it would just cause us to revisit it, because when sunsets come up, to revisit it and see where we're at. And you can just lift the sunset at that point.
And are we talking about the sunset just for the bicycle or for the motorcycle as well? Or do you want to just do the bicycle program, or you don't want to do the whole kit and caboodle? It'll bring the motorcyclists in.
Will this new technology affect them as well?
Yeah.
Well, then it's...
Then make the whole chapter.
Just revisit it. Maybe we still need to continue it, and we will
idea.
Know how it has been functioning.
Yeah.
But if the technology is there, then maybe that's an impetus for the people and the technology to get things rolling.
Okay. Why don't we do this? Senator Carlson, if you're in agreement to that, because I think that that's probably a good idea. I think that we're going to need to come back and look at this in a few years and see if there's any statistical data that shows that there was an increase in accidents or anything like that, because if that's the case, then we definitely want to remove this from law for both the bicyclists and the motorcyclists. The one thing I know about riding my bicycle is if you're sitting out there at the edge of an intersection, you're in danger, and it's better to just move along, and get out of harm's way. But, no, I understand this, but I want to do it a little bit different. I want to give Bonnie a little chance so that she can get this right, but I want it to be reverse, okay, so that the Department of Public Safety would have to bring us information saying that this is not a good idea, and then we'll take it out. Because if we put it on right now, basically what happens is the law will go away, and if we forget about it, then it's gone, and we've forgotten about it. So if we put kind of that reverse referendum on it.
But, Mr. Chairman, I don't think the bicyclists and motorcyclists would let us just let the law go away if there hadn't been a resolution.
Well,
they're sharper than that.
That's probably true, too. I was trying to kind of round the rough edge off.
Whatever. I'm not sure I understand exactly what you're talking about. But
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we don't want to ask the department for another report now I think about it, because we don't have that kind of money. Why don't we just go ahead with the Sunset Senator Carlson, and then we'll just we'll let you have the opportunity to come back in front of the committee next year or the year after and do like Senator Metzen just did a few minutes ago and remove the sunset. How's that?
We're speaking of the sunset for authorizing this. Is that what I'm hearing correctly? Is that
right? We're going to give you a window of like 3 years to operate with. Once we get through next session, once you guys get through next session and the following session and the third session, you can remove the repeal. How's that?
Mr. Chair?
You can do whatever.
I think Senator Carlson's confused. The law would go into effect.
Correct.
Then it would expire after 3 years unless it was renewed.
And, Mr. Chair, and Senator Gribble, we're speaking of the law with respect to motorcycles also.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
One's going to follow the other one. Mr. Chair.
The only thing I'm really concerned about is that we not key it towards installing new technology, because we're talking about thousands of intersections that are now controlled by intelligent controllers. And we wouldn't want this law to try to force any kind of mass change. So
Senator,
if we're looking
Senator
at
Watt.
Just safety, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Senator Watt.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't going to say anything as we were going through the bill, because we already have an affirmative defense in the books. But if we're going to sunset an affirmative defense in the book and make it go away, might I suggest that then you send the bill to judiciary, and when it gets to us, maybe by then everybody would have talked, and then we could look at it. Because if we're going to sunset an affirmative defense and make it go away totally, then I think we should take a look at it.
All right. Senator Carlson has moved to amend Senate File 2453. Council, could you give us what that amendment would look like?
Mr. Chair, the amendment, and I didn't exactly figure out where it would sit yet, but it would say subdivision 9 expires as to violations that occur on or after blank. I don't know what date you're wanting motion.
3 years.
And also
August 1st, 2014.
August 1st of 2013. Do you want, and did you want an effective date on the, an immediate effective date on the change, or August 1?
Immediate.
10.
I believe we have August 1st as the effective date.
That's kind of by de facto, that's what happens all the time. Why don't we put it upon enactment, okay?
Right.
Yeah. All right. On the Carlson motion to amend, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? motion does prevail. Senator Carlson would move that Senate File 2453, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. The committee is adjourned. Thank you very much.
All right. It's been fun.